For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now I can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May I unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth. Good morning. It's great to see everybody here. And I'm Aishin, Nancy Easton, giving the talk today because Taigen is away in North Carolina. And I wanted to talk about something that I've been sitting with and thinking about and working with for a while. And when I originally thought I was going to write this talk, I thought it was going to be about categories. And as I was working on it, I realized that just doesn't kind of encapsulate it or at all. So although it's part of it, it's certainly part of it, I want to talk about, I've been working with a chapter from Taigen's book, Just This Is It, about our ancestor, Dongshan Liangzhi, and his teachings. And the chapter that I've been working with is based on a very famous koan from the Book of Serenity, number 98, which is entitled Always Close. And it is a koan about a particular teaching and sort of question and answer of Dongshan's. And it's very, very short. So I'll just go ahead and read it to you, and we can sit with that and ponder that for a moment. The actual case is, goes, a monk asked Dongshan, among the three Buddha bodies, which one does not fall into any category? And Dongshan said, I am always close to this. So, as probably everyone is already familiar with, koans are really just teaching stories that have been handed down to us from the ancestors, and they are teaching stories or poems that encourage us to look a little bit deeper than our ordinary sort of surface, intellectualized way of looking at things or thinking about things, and yet we also have to use those faculties too. We have to use our sort of deluded thinking mind in order to be able to, work with and ponder what's being said. And yet we also have to be able to transcend that. So in thinking about, the three bodies of Buddha, even the question itself is kind of a paradox because it really categorizes things. I've been getting things that people are sending me on Facebook, you can take these quizzes that show you, which Elvis song fully matches your personality, or which thing do you somehow fit into? What is your personality type, or who are you? And all of these things are categorizing. And so when we think about, the three bodies of Buddha, which one is the one that doesn't fall into categories? I think in terms of using our thinking mind, maybe it helps to know a little bit about what the three bodies of Buddha are. And so when this question is asked, it really refers to the Dharmakaya body, the Sambhogakaya body, and the Nirmanakaya body. And so the Dharmakaya body of Buddha is called the reality body. It's Buddha as the nature of reality, the way that everything is pervaded with Buddha nature or awakening. The Sambhogakaya is known as the bliss body of Buddha, which is also considered to be the reward or fruit of meditative practice or awakening. And then the Nirmanakaya body is considered the manifested body, the body of the historical Buddha as a person. And so, you know, you might be familiar with these from when we chant them in our meal chant, you know, where we're chanting Vairochana Buddha, pure Dharmakaya. That's what we're talking about. It's the reality body of Buddha, Buddha as the nature of reality. Lochana Buddha, complete Sambhogakaya. So the way that we receive these fruits of meditative practice or awakening. And then finally, myriad Nirmanakaya, Shakyamuni Buddha, myriad Nirmanakaya, the manifested body of Shakyamuni Buddha. And even in that one statement, myriad Nirmanakaya, what is that? You know, how if Shakyamuni Buddha was just one person who was manifested in the world, how can we have myriad Nirmanakaya? And I think this relates to, something that I think has been coming up in talks for the past, month or so, ways in which, the Buddha is actually manifest through us, through all of the ways that we remember Buddha and understand Buddha and practice Buddha's teachings. In those ways, the Buddha body is manifested, throughout all beings, throughout, and has been handed down, from warm heart to warm heart over, many, many, many lifetimes to us. So even in this one category, we get to start to have a glimpse of the way in which even the Nirmanakaya transcends categories, even the Buddha transcends categories. So we have the three bodies of Buddha. Which of the three? It does not fall into any category. Which brings me to want to talk about categories and, what are categories? We have all kinds of categories of things, book, lectern, cup, recording device, floor, fans, all of the myriad things. And, maybe one of my favorite examples is chair. You can see, there's a few of them sort of scattered around the room. And when we think of a chair, probably everybody has their own image in their mind of what comes up when you think of a chair, but you can look at that one and you can know that it's a chair. It's got a back, it's got a seat, it's got legs, you can sit on it. Those are some things that maybe make it a chair, but it's also, really made of non-chair elements. So we live in this world of things, and I think, I at least tend to think that these categories of things come from outside me. But when you stop and, sort of turn your mind inward a little bit, you can recognize that it's actually, it's actually the mind that is categorizing things. If you, you may notice this sometimes in Zazen, where, things just sort of, they loosen up a little, and we're not so fixated on, whether that conversation that we had with someone earlier was positive or negative, or, is that a good person or a bad person? We can loosen up our categories around these things. And so, on the one hand, I think we are actually hardwired to categorize. We need to know, we've needed to know for eons what things are safe to eat and what will poison you, for instance. So categories are very helpful when we think about how we can go about our daily life. And yet none of them are really completely true or completely false. And so we need to find a way to work with, you know, that mind that categorizes. And that brings me to want to also talk about it's not really a dichotomy in Zen, but I can't think of a good word for it. In Zen practice, we have ways of talking about, you know, the universal sort of truth or presence and or sense of oneness, and then the particular. That, or some people call it, you know, the absolute and the phenomenal. You know, we have, we're trying in practice to connect a little bit more with our sense of the universal, and yet in our world, you know, the universal can really only manifest through particulars, through phenomena, causes and conditions that we often, you know, the particulars and the causes and conditions always fall a little bit short, which I think actually is the first noble truth, that everything is, you know, whether it's suffering or whether everything is sort of incomplete or everything is, everything is a little bit out of whack, which I think is the original meaning of dukkha. It's because we have we recognize that there are these universal qualities, that really can only manifest in, you know, very imperfect kinds of ways in our four-dimensional universe. And so something else that I want to say about koans in my translation of the Book of Serenity, there is a foreword by Robert Aitken, who was a, you know, very famous Zen teacher in the 1900s. And one of the things he says in his foreword is that a koan is a window that shows the whole truth, but from just a single vantage. So that's kind of, you know, the way in which a koan is trying to work with us or trying to teach us, and a way that we can maybe try to think about grasping that. That when we read a passage like, you know, which of the three bodies of Buddha does not fall into any category, and then the answer is, I'm always close to this, we can think about in what way is this expressing something universal, but from a particular vantage point. And so I like thinking about that relationship between the universal and the particular as maybe not so much, you know, imperfect or incomplete or out of whack, but maybe just one limited vantage point. The same way that we all are limited vantage points in the world. We have our own perspective or our own Dharma position. So I'm going to go a little wrong book. I'm going to go a little bit further with this koan, and read the verse that is connected with it by Hongzhe. And the verse actually says, "Not entering the world, not following conditions, in the emptiness of the pot of ages, there's a family tradition. White duckweeds, breeze gentle, evening on an autumn river. An ancient embankment, the boat returns, a single stretch of haze." So Hongzhe is saying, you know, that there is something that is not entering the world, not following conditions, and I think that that is, you know, kind of pointing to the universal. And then the family tradition. When we think about family, we think about you know, maybe the word familiar is one that connects family tradition to being intimate. You know, the way that maybe Dongshan is saying, I am always close to this. You know, is he, don't know if Dongshan is always close to the three bodies of Buddha or if he's always close to this question. But so in emptiness, there is a way in which we are always close to this, well, this family tradition of always being close. always being intimate with our experience. And then, you know, he then talks about at the end a single stretch of haze. So therefore, we have categories, right? You know, we need these to get through life. But we all each extend beyond our categories. If you think about yourself, you know, there are ways in which you might categorize yourself, you know, and just pause for a moment with whatever comes to mind. And when you think about how you might categorize yourself, you can think about ways in which, okay, I fit in that category, but, you know, I think for most of the categories you can come up with, you can think of ways in which you're not a perfect example of that category. We don't completely fit into categories. And actually, in things like gender studies, there's a lot of, you know, research that shows that there is more variability within, you know, even just the two very simple categories of men and women than there is across men and women. Men, you know, there are many, many masculine traits are shared by women, many feminine traits are shared by men, but we think of these, and I won't even get into being transgender and the ways in which we have come to realize how limiting these two gender categories that we've, you know, kind of maybe grown up with really can be. But even in thinking about the two categories, there are so many ways in which nobody really falls completely into one category or the other. And so we, you know, can't quite, you know, we each extend beyond our categories. We can't fit into these categories. Another example is the ways in which in Zen practice or in Buddhist practice, we have precepts like not killing, not taking what is not given, not using false speech. And although while we have these precepts, and these precepts are a way of living as an expression of Buddha or the mind of Buddha, we also, it's impossible to refrain from breaking the precepts. We need to, you know, eat some kind of living thing, whether even if it's vegetables, even if we, you know, become very, very pure in thinking about what is it that we are eating to live. We do, you know, we life is taken in order that something else can live. And so we're living all the time with this tension between our categories and the ways in which things are ambiguous or things just do not fit into these categories. And I think that this is the single stretch of haze that Hongzhe is talking about. It's literally the place where you look off into the horizon and you can't quite tell where the water meets the sky. You know, he's pointing to sort of a natural blurring of categories. You know, what's water? What's sky? Sky is actually, you know, partly water, so I think there is actually no clear-cut line, but we, you know, need to be able to do that. So how does this relate to our lives? You know, one way I think is that we may have, you know, different expressions of who we are throughout our lives, and so does everyone else. You know, we look around the room right now and we see, you know, older people, younger people, and yet, you know, that's just who we appear to be right now. Even, you know, as we grow older, you know, we still contain all of the experiences that we've had over life. You know, so in a way, you know, there's still a child, you know, that's here in all of us. And so we look a certain way, but there's really, you know, much more to us. And that is true for everyone. You know, so one way to think about this is, you know, when we meet people, we are you know, very rapidly and actually unconsciously sort of applying categories to them. And that sort of partly determines, you know, how we respond to that person. Are they a threat? Are they, you know, potentially friendly? And so we, you know, we have these categories and we need these categories, but we also need to maybe think about how to connect with the person beyond what they, with people beyond what they appear to be. Another thing I have been thinking about is, you know, how this relates to Zazen practice. And so, you know, as we sit, we are really just, you know, expressing the willingness to sort of be present with whatever comes up, be available to looking at it, you know, letting it go. And I think this tends to break down our categories a little bit. You know, in terms of thinking about how Zazen practice here on our cushions affects our engagement with the world, I think that Zazen does tend to, you know, soften up our ability to, or our tendency to hold on to categories. One of the names for Buddha was the Tathagata, which means the one that has just come. And part of what we are doing when we're sitting Zazen is sitting and reflecting on, you know, what is this that is coming up right now? You know, what is it that's arising now that is leaving? And, you know, and we're trying to, as Dongshan's teacher Yunyan said, we're trying to cultivate an appropriate response. The ability to really meet reality as it's arising right now. And as it's arising now in ways that are maybe below the surface of what we ordinarily might encounter using categories. So, you know, sometimes this might involve using categories or working with the particulars of the world, and other times it might require us to just open to the universal. But by observing, you know, whatever is coming up, without grasping it, that really is how we become intimate with it. And so, you know, I think part of what is, you know, encapsulated in Dongshan's statement, I'm always close to this, is that very, you know, just being intimate with what's coming up in a moment. It's, I think, easier to see when we're sitting Zazen because we've cut down on the distraction, but it's coming up all the time. You know, there's never really a break from that. So I want to go back to the koan, and I'll just read it again. You know, the question that was posed to Dongshan was, among the three bodies of Buddha, which one does not fall into any category? And Dongshan says, I am always close to this. So now, having talked about some of these other aspects of categories and universal in particular, I want to go back and talk about the three bodies of Buddha in a little bit of a different way. You know, the Dharma, so the Dharmakaya Buddha, or Dharmakaya body of Buddha, is Buddha as the nature of reality, or awakening as the nature of reality. And when we think about it, we can, you know, readily see that reality or nature is awake and alive and responding and evolving. And things, you know, things happen, and then in response to that, other things are happening. And so, you know, in thinking about, or by understanding Dharmakaya body or reality, you know, we can really bring ourselves into some harmony with that by recognizing that, you know, when we do this, it leads to a good effect, and we do this, it leads to a not so good effect. And so by responding with reality and engaging with reality, you know, I think we can then begin to cultivate this appropriate response. At the same time, you know, the Sambhogakaya body, or the reward of meditative practice or awakening, actually, you know, brings out a different maybe aspect of the bodies of Buddha or Buddha itself, really. One of the examples that Taigen gives in Just This Is It as an example of Sambhogakaya is Amida Buddha. And Amida Buddha is the central figure, or one of the central figures at least, of Pure Land Buddhism. And Amida Buddha is kind of in heaven, is in sort of this blissful state. And one of the things that Pure Land Buddhism highlights, and it's not that it's different from Zen Buddhism, but it's really more emphasized, is the way that we can't do anything by ourselves, and so there's a little bit more of a focus in Pure Land Buddhism on sort of entreating Amida Buddha to help and to intervene and other forces along with Amida Buddha, because there's a great recognition and emphasis on the fact that we cannot do anything by ourselves. We think about maybe a better counterexample would be Theravada Buddhism, where we're trying to purify the mind and kind of release cravings and release grasping, and this would be sort of the real other end of the spectrum, recognizing that because everything arises together, there's a way in which we really need everything to awaken and everything to assist us in awakening. And I think that there's a line in Dogen's Genjo Koan that kind of encapsulates this nicely, where he says to carry the self forward and experience the myriad things is delusion. That the myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. And so so I think the Sambhogakaya is also very alive and responding and happening, and so also kind of not really falling neatly into a category. Finally, we have the Nirmanakaya body, or the manifested body of historical Buddha, as well as historical us. That we are maybe expressing the universal from within our particular place or our Dharma position. We are, all of us, as was the historical Buddha, to some extent finite or limited. We're born, we live, we die, we pass away, and we live on in some ways through people who remember us, or through some things that we may have done in our lives, through some of our karmic action. We have our categories, but we also transcend them. We're also made up of our experiences, and we can change. So there's more that goes into us, and there's more that comes out of us than just this very finite thing. So in terms of going back to the ways in which, what I read you, the quote from Robert Aitken about, a koan being a window that shows the whole truth, but from just a single vantage. I kind of want us to think about how maybe each of these three bodies of Buddha, as well, including ourselves, are also windows that point to, the universal reality through a particular vantage. So it's, not so much a category, but just a different viewing point of something universal. Each one, is sort of alive and kind of changing and evolving and responding all the time. It nothing is static and categorizable, and yet at any one given point, they're reflecting something different back to us. So. In thinking about what it means to be close to this, and maybe how it relates to Zazen, or bringing our Zazen mind to our daily lives, I think we can, you know, think about how we experience suchness, or think about the ways in which what it is that we are experiencing right now is maybe pointing to a larger truth that is less, you know, less immediately tangible. Not maybe getting fooled by categories that we seem to see, but, you know, using them when they're useful, and then putting them down when they're not. But also, you know, living with the question of, you know, what is this? What category might this be, or what might my tendency to categorize be telling me about what it is that I'm experiencing? You know, that everything, instead of grasping at answers, maybe just sitting with the question, you know, and recognizing that any answers we might find to these kinds of questions are really incomplete. There was something that just came up for me while I was saying this, and now I can't remember what it is. But just, you know, allowing things to unfold, you know, maybe just holding on to things very loosely. And, oh, that's what it was. You know, really considering how everyone that we encounter, regardless of what we observe or how we might categorize them, and everything we encounter is really something that is here to teach us something. You know, when we think about, you know, the whole world being your teacher, it's each individual can be a teacher, you know, and regardless of, you know, status, or you know, regardless of really who's saying it or what exactly is being said, there's something that we can learn from that, and there's a way that we can maybe you know, work with that situation to either harmonize with it, or you know, if it seems to be a harmful situation, to kind of, you know, maybe work to try to disassemble it. I think we often maybe approach things in the world like they are, you know, static entities. And I'm thinking of, you know, without getting into the specifics, some of the real turmoil that's happening in the elections right now. And, you know, the ways in which, or you know, with things like climate change, the ways that we go about helping those situations to change or improve really requires us to really understand, you know, what are the things that go up and come together in making this situation, and what are the ramifications of this situation, what are the ramifications of the things that we might try to do to be helpful, and, you know, really if we want to change something, you really have to understand it very intimately in order to be able to affect some beneficial change. So I started off thinking I was going to be talking about categories, and you know, as I got closer to what I needed to say or wanted to say, I realized that you know, kind of just like this, I really had to just continue to sit with the question, you know, and just to continue to be close to something. So that's, I think, maybe where I want to stop and leave my part of the discussion. I'm hoping we can have a little bit of a discussion about this, or about, you know, really anything that people would like to bring up if you have particular questions. So thank you. Hi, Libby.
Thank you so much. I feel much more connected to that thought than I have before. There's something, especially particular, I feel like the first part of it has always felt kind of cryptic and meaningless to me. You know, I was like, I don't care even if the question, I don't care what the answer is, I'm going to answer the question, I don't know why it's being asked. But what I've always liked about it, and what I feel like you helped make more tangible, I guess, is how it ends. That it sort of begins in what could potentially be like an intellectualized way. Like if you tried to answer that question at that level of, well, let's talk about, you know, not having categories and which one is the little, you know, it becomes sort of philosophical. And then to answer it by saying I'm always close to this, it becomes almost physical. Which feels much more connected to what's, you know, it's pointing at what's being expressed. Or it's hard to even find words for it because it points to the wordless. Which I felt like is where you sort of took us, or at least that's how I experienced it, was that you were sort of ending with that piece about I'm close to this. And as you got close to what you were sitting with, the intellectualized version of it, like you said, the thing is helpful, it's sort of good to kind of lay all that stuff out there and play with it, but then play with it and then let it settle and
back
to something that really can't be expressed with words.
Yeah, thank you. For me, it also did the same thing of like, I want to approach it like this, and then you have to kind of pull it apart a little bit. I've had a similar reaction to this koan, but many other, you know, koans, where it's like, I want to get to the answer. Let's, you know, like I feel I don't always know how to engage with what's being said, and even the commentary doesn't, you know, always make that super helpful. But I actually was reading through the translator's note when I was working on this, and you know, one of the things that Thomas Cleary says is I'll try to find the he's saying that although the ancient Chan masters would throw in, you know, they'll throw in references from all over the place that were familiar, you know, maybe to people at the time that they were teaching this originally. Those references, or who's saying it, or, you know, who wrote this commentary, or what's, not who wrote the commentary, but sometimes the commentary will quote particular people. And he says at one point that none of that is really so important as the meaning. It's not so important, you know, the reference isn't so important, except to understand what's being referred to. You don't have to continue to, you know, intellectually delve into the reference, but to think about, you know, what the reference is, maybe has to offer you, you know, and that may be, you know, it kind of responds to the inquiring impulse, you know. So if you want to continue to study that, it's okay. But if you don't, it's okay to sit with, you know, some information, you know, to have a little bit more information about, you know, even what the three bodies of Buddha are, and, you know, how we would distinguish them, or what's important about them. At the same time, you know, I think that when we think about, even, you know, as I unpacked a little bit about the three bodies of Buddha, it's not so necessary. We could have said the three whatevers, you know, which of the three treasures does not, you know, fall into any category. And I think that we would have maybe arrived at a similar place with the unpacking. So I think that that's more kind of what he's trying to say, that there's a meaning that doesn't require, you know, dogged picking through of the particulars. But thank you. Howard, thank you.
On categorical thinking, and also, you know, the limits of thinking, as someone who still to this day has strong inclinations towards formal philosophy, I ever since I started practicing more seriously, instead of just, you know, putting my hopes into formal philosophy, the really interesting thing with Zazen is always that I always like to think of Zazen as sitting as taking the food of experience with me to the seat and digesting it. But both in a conscious way and an unconscious way. I can consciously try as much as I want to break it down, just as my stomach might break down my food into its constituent parts. Breaking them down into the constituent parts helps me recognize, like, okay, well, this person, I had thought of them, put them into this category. I gave them these identifiers, and I thought that, oh, they're going to act this way, they're going to do this, they must be into this sort of thing. When I start breaking that down, I just realize, oh, that's just assumptions that I made. Those prevented me from having, like, a more real, I guess, real encounter with that person. But at the same time, an attempt for me to attempt to break that down all the way, it doesn't work. And that's at the core of the mystery for me of Zazen, is that I can try as I might to completely rationalize or categorize my own thinking by breaking out of my categories. It doesn't work either. And so there's just some strange kernel that gets broken open. I'm not really sure what it is, and I can only really describe it to myself in words as the sort of oddness of Zen. What something you said earlier reminded me of, you know, a reflection of each other. Having that practice and trying to, when I encounter that humility on the cushion, trying to bring that humility outwards, I'm reminded of that. I can't remember exactly all the details with it, but the jewel Dedekindra, where we are all jewels in a much larger network of jewels, that we all reflect each other. We are particulars who do reflect the universal network of jewels. And I think I actually wrote something in Zen Questions, or he quoted somebody who says something in Zen Questions, where if you tugged at it, all the jewels around you are affected too. Anything that happens to you, anything that you do affects others around you.
So. Yeah. Thank you. I actually feel like sometimes that's what's hard about trying to write a talk at all, is that you're to the extent that I even understand these things, it's so hard to like then put it into something that can be like comprehensibly spoken and listened to, because of that, because everything seems to lead to everything else, and at some point in doing the talk, you have to just be like, okay, yeah, we're not getting into that. as salient as it might be. But I think you're also kind of maybe talking about an aspect of the middle way, that we can't hold on to the categories, we can't completely ignore them. You know, sometimes they're appropriate, sometimes they're not. Like the monk who said, you know, sometimes I raise my eyebrows and that's okay, and sometimes I raise my eyebrows and that's not okay. And so we have to, that's where I think being always close with it very much falls into play. We have to really be intimate with, what's happening. And maybe to also accept that anything we can say or do is always going to be a little bit wrong. You know, it's always going to be a little bit of a mistake, which is, you know, really the other thing that's hard about writing a talk. I know we're getting close to 11, but it is 11. If anyone has one more question or state comment or observation, Alex, thanks.
I really like this koan in the sense that really, as much as it can be simply expressed, I think it does a great job of expressing this idea. In my experience, the way I think about it, the relationship between the universal and the everyday is just kind of like a razor's edge, where it's always a constant push and pull between these two aspects. And for me, like, in a lot of conflict that comes in my life happens when I expect the universal and I get.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And I think that's true. Like, I find so for myself that that's, and that the razor's edge there is this push and pull between my expectation that I'm going to have a universal experience, and it's often an everyday experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Being okay with that, I think part of the practice for me is being okay with that constant push and pull of these two aspects of life.
Yeah. So true, and we're not in control of it. I think is part of what you're saying too. That I've been talking about it like, oh well, we need categories, or we categorize, or we do this, but it's we're not always in control. Maybe we're never in control. Maybe that whole control thing is an illusion. But yeah, the idea that we expect universal, but get a limited viewpoint or something particular. So, thank you everyone for your kind and generous attention. Let me just